You're listening to Pod for Ham, a podcast from The Incomparable that's all about the musical Hamilton, taking it one track at a time through the original Broadway cast recording. Every episode features different groups of interesting people talking about a single track. Visit us on the web at pod4ham.com or follow us on Twitter at pod4ham.
The election of 1800.
Can we get back to politics, please?
Yo. Welcome back to Pod for Ham. We are moving towards the end game of this musical, and this is the song that sets everything in motion for the final confrontation in Weehawken. I'm Chip Sutterth.
I'm Alyssa Frankie.
I'm Elsa Shunnison Henry.
I'm Scott Canaster.
And I'm Kathleen Showalter.
And right at the beginning, poor Thomas Jefferson and James Madison ask, can we get back to politics, please? We've just been through the ringer in terms of the emotion of the musical with Hamilton's loss and begging for forgiveness and It's Quiet Uptown and all of that. And now we're back into sort of the stuff that most of us came to Hamilton for, I guess, or that's most of us think about Hamilton, an American musical about, right?
Yes, yep. I think, by the way, that was a really good please there, Chip.
I was working on my voice breaking, you know, it was lots of practice.
I remember the first time I heard the start of this song, it felt a little abrupt that, you know, we were so deep in the emotion, like you said, and just with those couple of lines, we were, Jefferson's Can We Get Back to Politics actually sounded a little harsh. And I guess in subsequent listenings, I've come to appreciate it more, but it really turns the show around on a dime back where it needs to be.
It's almost like an old-fashioned title card from a soundless movie or a black and white where you all of a sudden are like, and now it's 1800. It allows them to not have to go there organically, but to do that turning on a dime, the vocal quality and the differentiation from the melodic story that came beforehand stands in for a lot. Makes me wonder if there was something else at some point that they cut out.
I'm not sure, but it's also very, very self-aware or meta. You know, Jefferson and Madison are right there with the audience, right?
This was actually one of the first solid laughs that I had in the second act, and it got me ready for the rest of the emotional buildup of just there's this little bit of break from the grief. I had a solid laugh because it was so out of place. And then we go immediately back into the emotional turmoil as we get prepared for the duel in Weehawken.
I think it's sort of a necessary laugh, but otherwise the audience is slogging through the entirety of Act Two.
Right.
Right.
Well, there is an element of Act Two that I think it's true for a lot of us, probably, that Act One gets more plays if you look at your counters than Act Two, because Act Two is more difficult. And I'm interested in the quality of that laughter. Is it a laugh at the actual line, or is it the kind of laugh that you laugh in church or you laugh at a funeral, almost like a breaking of tension rather than pure amusement? That they're like that title card like punctures something rather than is actually comedic in itself.
I think it's a little of both. On stage, Madison comes out not only asking with his voice breaking, please, but he's actually wiping away his eyes. You know, it's almost sort of a wink to the audience. Okay, we've all been through the ringer. We know that. I, Lin-Manuel Miranda, wrote these few songs that were calculated to really, really put the screws to your emotions. Now we got to move on.
Ah, so Jefferson and Madison aren't speaking to the audience. They're speaking to the composer.
I hear what you're saying when you say that, but there's a way in which I think Jefferson and Madison are two of the characters, particularly Jefferson, who speaks to the audience the most throughout the whole show. The fourth wall is pretty transparent translucent. I'm not sure. Coming in and out of reality for Jefferson very, very often.
Yes.
Let's back up, and I call upon our historians to help us make sense of this situation. At this point in American history, elections were basically run like Calvin Ball. How is it in the world that we wound up with Jefferson and Burr facing each other in the House of Representatives. Can we have a little bit of background that the musical elides leaves out? That's the word.
Well, I'm not a historian, but I'll gladly, I read the internet. Elsa's the real historian, as far as I know. But I kind of became fascinated with this because it's an edge case and I'm one of those nerds. So, they wound up tied because originally, in the Electoral College, every elector had two votes for president. And because of the rise of political parties like the Democratic Republicans, and apparently also because of a flaw in the scheme to elect people in the Electoral College, every elector voted for both Jefferson and Burr, every elector for the Democratic Republicans. And since they won a majority of the electoral votes, we ended up with a tie. I say we, I was not around then, but I'll take it as my heritage. And so I guess luckily the framers had put into the Constitution a clause for what happens if there's a tie in the Electoral College, in which case the House votes one vote per state. And it wasn't just tied at that point. There were 35 more votes in the House that were tied as well, until, in part apparently because of Hamilton's campaigning, Jefferson won, as the musical says, in a landslide, 10 states to 4, I believe, was the vote.
So it's I'm actually looking at the electoral map right now. And cool. One thing that I kind of want to note, just because we're talking about the structure of elections, is that the election lasted from October 31st to December 6th. So it's long in terms of just how long it takes to actually have the election.
I will never complain about the length of an election ever, ever again.
Right. So I think that's kind of important to realize, is like, this is a really long time for people to be fighting over who's going to end up being the president. And this was a really vicious political battle. And then you add in the states, which is that there were 9 states that were carried for Thomas Jefferson and 7 for John Adams. So it was a landslide, sort of, but that's only by percentage. It's not by how many states.
But as far as Aaron Burr is concerned, it's an emotional landslide, shall we say.
I think Lynn did a good job of keeping this complexity that we're talking about now, keeping that out of the show, because imagine this conversation set to music, it would be a 12-minute number and everybody would be asleep.
Well, no, I would be tap dancing.
I was thinking it would be the second act of 1776.
Essentially.
Are you saying, Elsa, that the fact that Charles C. Pinckney was not included in these lyrics really got under your skin?
No, because the election of 1800 is probably my least favorite thing to teach.
let's talk about how this song goes. Jefferson and Madison come on and soliloquize, and they've expressed their desire to get back to politics, and yet it's not really going well. Jefferson's flummoxed and frustrated about how things are going. And as I was listening to this, we've just come, as we record this, we've just come off of remarkably bitter election, shall we say. But this election... Yeah, but this election and this song actually reminds me a whole lot, and it draws so much from another contentious election from 2004, when Jefferson's saying, at least they know I know where France is. There's some serious Bush versus Kerry stuff sprinkled through this entire song.
Absolutely. And it's interesting because he's also making callbacks to other shows about elections. This number feels very similar to, in Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson, the election song in that show. So it's sort of weaving all of these different electoral references, whether it's Bush or whether it's Jackson or whether it's the actual election we're talking about. It's all very election-centric, obviously.
I couldn't believe that he worked in the gag, like you could have a beer with him. And pretty much everybody in the audience knows exactly what that refers to.
That was definitely a laugh line.
And with the uptalk at the end, like you could have a beer with him, made it feel very modern. it's anachronistic to the show and really sets it more in the 2000s.
That's a great point, because a lot of the another male voter, the sort of non-identified, non-main character comments are very modern. The song itself musically is quite modern in that you have Burr with an electric guitar, I think. I don't think he usually sounds like that. The piece of the music that comes in here is a little bit more modern as well. But these speakers could be and are just quotations. I think all of them are quotations from that we saw on the television in terms of voter comments during recent elections.
Mm-hmm. Before we get into some of the more recent electoral parallels, I do want to get to the performance and the staging. We do get our third what of the musical. David Diggs is always good for a what in yes. Hamilton, an American musical. I love how Madison is the smart guy. Just sort of lays out the plan for Jefferson, sees everything so clearly. And then we go from that to a very ebullient Aaron Burr.
Yes, and a different Aaron Burr than anywhere else, I think, in the show, as he figures out how to campaign, but never really likes it. And in fact, when he says, honestly, it's kind of draining, you can just hear the how much he hates it when he expresses that to, I guess he's speaking to Hamilton in the song.
He does convey that, I think, in that line. But the fact that this is a new musical style for Burr does show a change or a difference in the character from what we've seen previously, not just in his words. Some of them are the same and some of them are different, but he sounds different, more upbeat, less, I want to say Machiavellian, but I think that might be the wrong word here, but it's a perkier sound that's given to him, a more triumphant, a more putting himself forward musical quality that comes with Burr here.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if anybody else is hearing that.
He's definitely talking more and smiling more, wouldn't you say?
That's
yeah,
true.
Just even listening to the music, it sounds like he's got this pained smile on his face the entire time. Someone mentioned earlier that it sounded the music sounded more modern. And I think one of the interesting things about that is Burr sort of set he's sort of the father of modern politics and campaigning. And it is like absolutely draining. You know, I hear the exhaustion in a voice of you have to constantly be in front of people, constantly be presenting the most upbeat, perky, absolutely, I'm totally engaged in whatever it is that is you're saying at this moment, personality constantly. Really established a new way of how presidential candidates interact with voters. So it's interesting that they bring in both that pained perkiness to the song and also that sort of more modern sound to it.
Yeah, it's sort of a dry disapproval that Hamilton notes when says, "You're openly campaigning. That's new." You know, back in the day, candidates were supposed to be above that sort of thing. Oh God! Can we go back? Can we go back, please? can we go back to distant removal, please? That moment when Burr says, "You know, I learned that from you." When Burr and Hamilton have this confrontation in the middle of the stage, Burr has been dancing all over the place. He has been animated. When the guy says, "You could have a beer with him," Burr drops to a knee and just pumps his fist like, "Yes, I've got this." He is the furthest from wait for it that you ever get in this musical, I feel like.
Yeah, there's a definite change in the choreography for Burr here and for the kinetic energy of how much space he covers. And there's a way in which, and I've only seen it with Leslie J. Odom. I haven't seen it with Victor Dixon yet. And Dixon is a more mobile actor in general on stage. But with Odom, he tended to be a very compact, held together presence on stage until about this point where the gestures get bigger, the movement happens faster. I totally agree with that tip.
But in the end, when Hamilton makes his grand announcement that his Federalists should throw their votes to the lesser of two evils, as he sees it, you've got Burr and Jefferson at opposite ends downstage, sort of standing up, waiting for the moment. Jefferson looks really disgruntled. This is not how it was supposed to go down. He's just pissed off. He knows that Hamilton is going to pick Burr. Hamilton does not. And the funniest thing about this song on stage is that, at least as Leslie Odom Jr. does it, he just sort of stands there with this frozen grin, the same grin that actually it's kind of draining, as Hamilton says, "Jefferson has my vote." Burr can't believe what he's hearing, and he's in denial. You see him go through the five stages.
Yeah, it's almost like he's been like smacked upside the face, but he can't. He knows he's on stage. You know, he's a political candidate who's just gotten smacked in public, but he's got to keep on smiling because, you know, yeah. Smile more.
And the reaction of the ensemble, the ooh that they do, is really great.
That's painful for Burr. Like, you can just,
yes.
You feel
like you really expect them to say, "Oh no, he didn't."
And he pretty much dances across the stage. Jefferson does. He's not exactly a gracious winner.
Fair.
No, he wouldn't.
No. And in the end, it ends with Burr talking less and smiling more once again, holding out his hand, saying, "I'm still vice president. I'm still going to be in the room, right?" And totally getting rejected.
So he does become vice president, but it's because of this that the Constitution is amended so that the second place winner no longer becomes vice president, that the two positions run together on a ticket.
Right. And there's a way in which that's something that Lynn elides here, that he just kind of it makes a much better turn into the next song if Burr is completely out of the room, that we don't know that Burr was in the room and not in the conversation. That's a level of perhaps too much complexity. It's much better to have him completely shut out with that great last line of, "Oh, hey, I'm president."
Now, Elsa, this wasn't actually the last straw. It's the last straw as far as the musical is concerned, but historically, this wasn't the last straw for Burr, was it?
No. So here's the part where my historical background falls slightly short, because I do a lot of research, but I'm actually a social historian, so I do a lot more with women and their place in the era. But basically, it's just everything about their relationship was terrible, and there's these letters that keep going back and forth, and I think, honestly, from what I've read, I'd almost think it's the correspondence that really is the straw. Because he just keeps saying awful things and won't respond to them, and Burr wants to, you know, he wants him to apologize, and Hamilton won't.
While I can see why it isn't entirely shown in the structure of the musical, it comes into the next song with the A.Ham and A.Burr, but it's so part of Hamilton's fatal flaw that he just can't shut up.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
One thing real quick before we move on, just because so you brought up you work with sort of women in this time period. One of the things I really liked about this song was the line, "It's 1800, ladies, tell your husbands, vote for Burr." And I think Lynn does such a good job at keeping the song flowing and keeping the momentum of the story going, but also pointing out sort of the fundamental flaws in the foundation of our country, of these are the groups of people that are being excluded from having a voice, having a say. And the song, the ensemble beforehand, it's men and women talking about the election and their choices. And it's women who are some of the most critical voices. And then this line comes up reminding everybody, these women couldn't vote for who their candidate was going to be, who their president was going to be. So I thought that was just a wonderfully written moment.
I just had such a different interpretation of that line that's really interesting. I think you're probably very correct. When I had read it, because I'm a historian as well, but I work on women's power in the medieval period. Mm-hmm. I thought it was such a great reference to how soft power can be used and how potent it can be. And
yes,
there's a way throughout this entire show that Lynn really foregrounds the way that you may have people moving armies, but people talking and women have power and agency, even if they don't have traditional authority, that I thought this was an underlining of that, particularly mm-hmm. given the fact that Burr himself was actually someone who submitted a bill to allow women to vote, and that in some ways Burr was more supportive of female public action than Hamilton even was, but that Hamilton certainly gets moved around by women quite a lot.
I love that reading of that too.
And I think that there's another reading to think about, which is that many of the men who were sort of in this situation are men who had very strong women who were part of the dialogue.
Yes.
I mean, Abigail Adams is fundamental to the dialogue that John Adams had about how he governed. And
right.
There are all of these women who were essentially power behind the throne.
Sure, and we use that, generally speaking, power behind the throne as a pejorative. And I think it's at least arguable that it's not, that it's quite an effective kind of power to be used that we should probably think about a lot more than we do now. And certainly Abigail Adams is a great example, but there are so many women behind the scenes, whether wives or other family members. There's some daughters involved as well. And it's actually something that, Elsa, I'd be really interested to hear or to see more of your work on social culture in this period, because my impression is that there are some real similarities to the way medieval courts worked in the way that you may not see in the newspaper every aspect of how decisions get made, but that in the room where it happens, that room is bigger than that single chamber where the two men are.
I absolutely would say that that's the truth. I mean, I especially think it's within the context of that line. I think it's a lot about how women were still in positions of power post-revolution. I mean, women were the ones sort of taking care of the homesteads, and they were the ones dealing with a lot of things that happened on the ground. So even though we don't see it, I think that there's a lot of undercurrents of women actually having a say in who their husbands vote for, because it is something that affects the whole family.
At the time of recording, it's towards the end of November, and we are sort of recovering from one of the most contentious elections in American history, at the same time that we're talking about a song about another seriously contentious American election. And I can't help thinking that some of us may have experienced some weird deja vu as we were listening to this song post the 2016 election.
Just a tad. You know, I think it's so interesting listening to this song now, when there is so much debate over the role of the Electoral College and the popular vote in selecting our president, you know, because we are witnessing sort of one of the first failures of the Electoral College, where political parties have evolved in such a way that the Electoral College stalls, that it does not have an ability to choose the next president. And then now we're dealing with a situation where the Electoral College is incredibly distorted from the actual national popular vote totals. And we see the machinations behind the scenes with the political parties and the main figures in the political parties choosing who's going to be president. And now we've sort of had a sort of similar party machinations over how does our primary process work? How are we pushing the people that we want to be the figureheads of our parties forward and supporting them as candidates? So there's a bit of deja vu going back and sort of realizing all of the situations that our founders couldn't have prepared us for. And the election of 1800 is taking place in the founders' lifetime. Like they are there in the middle of it, deeply involved in this election. So that to me is sort of gave me a lot of deja vu listening to it again.
Well, and it's interesting because this is, you know, this is the first time that it happens in the founders' lifetime. And the second time is the election of 1824, when exactly what happened in this election happens. So it's worth sort of recognizing that this is a situation the founders actually saw. Many of them were very old and about to die, but they still had that sort of like within the first generation or two, oh, this is the thing that could happen and we don't really know what to do about it.
I find it very interesting that the Electoral College, as I understand it, was originally set up to be a more deliberative body. The framers setting it up because of a fear of the popular vote, that there would be people voting based on emotions or ideas that would not be who could run the country best because they couldn't possibly know. They were uneducated, etc. And that's why we have a republic instead of a pure democracy. And so that's one of the reasons, as I learned in school anyway, that the Electoral College came to be. And then you fast forward now, and we have a problem with the Electoral College again, but it's kind of a different problem. It's almost like a total 180 of a shift, because now the popular vote doesn't match up with the Electoral College, but we have a lot more faith and there's in the popular vote than we did previously, or that we did then, or that we're willing to articulate. And certainly one of the reasons that you hear at this moment in November, as we're looking back at the election, is that people they want to trust their individual response. They don't want to trust perhaps the positions of educated men and women to make decisions for them.
Well, your point about the distrust of the mass group vote, but the trust of the individual group vote, I thought was an interesting point, because what I learned in school about the setup of the Electoral College was that it was part of the Federalist debate over the power that states would have.
Right.
So the votes in the Electoral College are equivalent to your representatives in the House and the Senate. And one of the reasons that this was put in place was because smaller states and also slaveholding states wanted to be able to exert a bit more political influence than perhaps the voting age public at that time, under the limitations of white landowning men, would have given them. And we're sort of in a bind right now over because of the way this Electoral College was set up, there are voters in certain states whose opinions are given far more political power than voters in other states. So we're not just wrestling over sort of, is this the, you know, do we trust the popular vote to choose the right candidate, but also is the structure of the Electoral College sort of fundamentally unfair, the way that it privileges votes in some states over others, especially mm-hmm. when you consider that history of who it was intended to enfranchise and disenfranchise.
Well, it's also interesting if you think about it that, you know, I've a lot of the comments I've heard over the last couple weeks have been people saying, oh, well, I thought that it was to balance, you know, making sure that California didn't overwhelm the rest of the smaller states with less of a population. And that's not what the initial intent was, but it certainly seems like that's how people frame it now, mm-hmm. which I think is an interesting revision of our perspective and worth sort of observing the fact that that's how people are seeing it now, even though that's not actually what's historically the case.
As well as the Electoral College thing, I think the language here can be really resonant with some of the language we heard in the election as well. And the one that I wanted to mention, just because it really kind of hit me hard, was Madison saying, "Ask him a question. It glances off. He obfuscates. He dances." Mm-hmm. And that being one of the remarks that was thrown at Hillary Clinton quite a bit, that she wouldn't apologize, wouldn't give a straight answer. And it's sort of fascinating that some of these same criticisms come back around again and again.
Mm-hmm. I definitely pick up on throughout this entire musical that he doesn't make a big deal. But as you said with ladies, tell your husbands vote for Burr, you know, the issues of the power imbalances between the states, how much to trust the voters, how much to, you know, all of those struggles are very much present in this musical. And I think that Hamilton, an American musical, does a great job of revealing that the problems that we're having now are problems that the founders had before, that they didn't have it all magically right at the beginning, and the compromises and failings of our political system are kind of they're there for everyone to see in this musical.
Mm-hmm.
Let's wrap up with final thoughts on the music. And Scott, I'd like you to, since you've been quiet for a while, I'd like to give you the chance to pipe in.
Well, despite the fact that I said that I felt a little cheated the first time I heard the song, because it took me out of my grief so abruptly, I love the song. I like the way that it summarizes what happened so wonderfully without getting into all the technical weeds and historical details that are fascinating but would stop the show. I love the voters' conversation. Actually, I noticed in looking at the lyrics while we were just talking that the women are identified in the lyrics as female voter. Now, I'm not sure if that's a mistake. It's probably just an oversight, but maybe whoever decided to say female voter was giving us an anachronistic wink, because they're not voters, as we discussed earlier. So I think the song moves the show along beautifully. It turns it from tragedy so wonderfully, and has some great rhymes, and it has David saying what. So it has everything.
Other closing musical thoughts?
I think that the callback to Washington on Your Side is here again an evidence of how carefully structured Lynn's musical is in reaching back within the show itself to bring back various themes, both musically and lyrically, but also the choreography and the staging. And you go from Washington on Your Side to One Last Time, and then 1800 to the election of 1800, and then you're moving into Your Obedient Servant, and they have a parallel narrative place in terms of, you move from a cabinet battle, Washington on Your Side, One Last Time, and then a really distinct change before the Adams administration. And he underscores those narrative moments really brilliantly in the way that he juggles repetition, I think, in the show.
Well, when next we gather for Pod for Ham, Hamilton is going to provide Aaron Burr with a list of 30 years of disagreements.
What could go wrong?
Everything.
Oh, everything, everything. So Your Obedient Servant will be up next time on Pod for Ham. Thank you all for listening. For Alyssa, Elsa, Scott, and Kathleen, I'm Chip, and so long for now.
You hear this guy? Man openly campaigns against me, talking about I look forward to our partnership.
It is crazy that the guy who comes in second gets to be vice president.
Ooh, you know what? We can change that. You know why?
Why?
Because I am the president.
Burr, when you see Hamilton, thank him for the endorsement.